Good morning. Two groups working to end sex trafficking in Hawaii have co-authored a bill to create a clearly defined sex trafficking statute. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and today we'll talk with Cash and John, the executive director of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery. Meanwhile, former Governor Linda Lingle's move to the mainland has some wondering if this is for her career or going to be just a hiatus. We'll talk about the impact on Hawaii's GOP with party chair and former Congresswoman Pat Saiki. On Monday, January 26th, it's The Conversation.
And classic soul in the form of musician Mike Lundy is out on a new vinyl 45. And what do you get when you mix clowning and acrobatics? Annika Hunter says that would be bow arrow. Those conversations and a few more after the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to a Monday, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Well, you know, we're doing all right here. Like many people, we've had our group struck with the flu, so those of us who are well are trying not to get it, and those of us who have got it are trying to get well.
Exactly, like many people.
You bet. Well, as we went off into the weekend, as some of us were getting sick, two organizations announced that they had co-authored a bill to ban sex trafficking. The bill, written by Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery and Imua Alliance, had been introduced by Senator Suzanne Chun Oakland and Representative John Mizuno. It would convert Hawaii's promoting prostitution laws into sex trafficking. That would bring the state into line with 48 other states which outlaw sex trafficking in their criminal codes. And to talk more about what this bill would do, Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery Executive Director Catherine Jean is with us this morning by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Over the last several years, you've had several wins, a couple of near misses, but really looking to separate the victims from the Johns and to change the way we look at prostitution and really understand the difference between promoting prostitution, as we have laws that use those terms, and sex trafficking. What specifically are those differences?
Well, you know, the main difference is the current statute's inability to identify victims as victims with the label of prostitute. And we've been fighting that for a really long time. This effort to establish Hawaii's sex trafficking law has been a decades-long battle, and we are now one of two states left in the nation that lacks a definition for sex trafficking by statute.
Why do you think it's been such a long time before we could even begin to change that language, if in fact that happens? What's taken Hawaii so long if there are 40 other eight states who have changes in their criminal codes?
Well, basically, we're working against a major age-long and archaic paradigm shift. we're urging that anyway. And we now know that there's more to prostitution than just being a victimless crime, that it being like you heard the stereotype of it being the world's oldest profession. Well, it's the world's oldest oppression that we see now. And prostitution is highly linked to sex trafficking. It's almost impossible to kind of separate the two without real intense investigation and new lenses to look at the issue and each victim separately.
So aside from changing our attitudes toward the people who are involved, how does the change in law allow better prosecution? Because according to Honolulu City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, this isn't, in his mind, a good move.
Well, he's part of the old school, right? And the old school doesn't like any changes. It took us several years to reform the Promoting Prostitution Code to what it is now, thankfully with Keith's help in the past. And when we started, that change, even we came up with a lot of opposition during the Carlisle administration when he was mayor. You know, the old guard doesn't really like change, but change needs to happen because crime evolves. And now we see that modern day slavery is a multi-billion dollar a year industry globally, probably more than $27 billion a year annually. That's by a conservative estimate. So it's really just kind of it's long overdue, we feel. And the things that would help with this new law, or really this change of title of an existing law, would be to gather appropriate and accurate statistics of sex trafficking. Now, that would help funding purposes to provide funds for aftercare for survivors. Not only that, but it would enable law enforcement within the system to identify victims appropriately as victims and not as prostitutes. Never assume that law enforcement or anybody regarding a victim and her healing, the impacts of re-victimization within the system just by that societal bias of being called a prostitute.
As you mentioned a little earlier, that with Keith Conchero's help in past, you've been able to move the law to this point. Why do you think that he might not be helpful in going forward if it's a matter of an attitudinal shift?
It's really interesting. I think, you know, what I've noticed about prosecutors is that change threatens their ability to win cases. The prosecutor's office, you know, to their defense, are really overburdened with a lot of cases. And not enough funding and not enough prosecutors to attack every case effectively and appropriately. We've seen that in the past with the inability to address sex assault cases appropriately. Well, that could be a mixture of maybe incompetence, but also lack of funding and lack of resources for the department. So any sort of change in statute is pretty threatening to the prosecutor's office because it might force them into court more often, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think that it's basically their job. But when you're stretched pretty thin, you kind of get a little bit more conservative about statutory changes.
And there's no way that it might keep them out of court more often if the law were changed to clearly delineate prostitutes as victims or more victim-oriented, and then to be able to go after the Johns?
You know, our argument is that they're going to go to court anyway because, in our experience, sex traffickers will always deny that they're sex traffickers. They will always deny that they forced anybody. So they will want to go to court. So, you know, really that question is kind of moot, but we've heard it from the prosecutor's office time and time again. But really, the bottom line is that, you know, Hawaii needs to have this defined because Hawaii is a major hub for sex trafficking. You see that in the many brothels that exist here, more than 100 in the Honolulu area alone, and they're operating as if they're legal businesses. That needs to stop. You see the increase of prostitution not only in Waikiki but downtown in some areas in the North Shore and Pearl City, and a burgeoning increase in local children being recruited into sex trafficking and prostitution.
That seems to point right back to those who demand or whose demand keeps the sex trafficking moving forward. Specifically, you want to be able to go after Johns. Does this change allow you to do that more effectively than in past?
Yes, absolutely, because right now, and I'm glad you brought that up, right now, Johns, or the purchasers of human beings for sex, are included in the same criminal statute as potential victims, the girls trapped in the sex trade, prostitute or prostituted persons, like we prefer to say. They're included in the same statute. So a sex trafficking law would clearly define the prostituted person as a victim, allow us to disaggregate then the offense of buying somebody for sex, and then enable us to increase the penalty for solicitation of sex if you were a buyer.
This was just introduced. The bill was just introduced. Do you have any idea of when it'll be heard?
No, we don't, but we're pretty confident that it will be scheduled for hearing. It's been a hot topic for both judiciary chairs throughout the past years. So we'll see. I mean, I think this year we have a better shot than any other year in the past.
Well, we won't have all that long to wait to see if that comes true. Thanks very much for giving us a little time this morning.
No problem. Thanks, Bethan.
Thanks very much. Catherine Gian is the executive director and co-founder of the Pacific Alliance to Stop Slavery. Her organization is the co-author of a bill to change the language in Hawaii's promoting prostitution laws to a more clearly defined sex trafficking statute.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, reviving the warmth of vinyl and the music it brought with it. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an animal that's very common in Hawaiian waters, but many might not even recognize that it's an animal. It belongs to a group of animals called cnidarians and also includes sea anemones and jellyfish. It's hard as a rock and is often mistaken for a rock or mineral, but unlike those inanimate objects, this look-alike has the ability to spawn. When it does, it creates a wide variety of living spaces for ocean life. Like other cnidarians, it has a single body opening with a mouth at the top surrounded by feeding tentacles. Those tentacles have stinging cells called nematocysts that catch food-drifting animals, especially tiny drifting plankton. Within the animal's tissues are microscopic algae that live in a symbiotic relationship with their host. The algae converts sunlight to energy and provides oxygen and food, and the host produces the carbon dioxide, nitrates, and phosphates that the algae need to survive. It's an amazing organism, and if you've ever been in the ocean, you've probably seen it. Today we're looking for its name, so do you know it? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, or you can wait for the answer later this hour.
Aloha, I'm Gina Searles from Hawaii State Ballet. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Old school soul music and vinyl recordings are natural partners. Back in the day when a high school kid could take home the latest Marvin Gaye or Aretha Franklin 45 for a buck, the warm sound of vinyl and the rich sound of the music were a perfect fit. Mike Lundy is reviving both the music and the recording medium with his new single on the Aloha Got Soul label. And Mike's with us, guitar in hand, this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, I remember, and I'm sure you too remember, when you go to see somebody, you'd go over to their room and you'd see the stack of 45s.
You got it.
And you'd go and look through their 45s, and that would tell you a lot about who that person was.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. I had a whole stack of them.
Me too.
I'm sure you did also, yeah.
A lot of them had labels like Motown and Stax and King Records with James Brown, all
there
those
you go.
Things.
Yeah,
I don't know. I miss those days.
I do too. They were fun times.
For one thing, you had the whole craft of the 45 creating a hit song because radio stations wouldn't play a song more than 3 minutes in length.
Exactly.
Usually about 2.5. Mm-hmm. So you had to get your message across pretty quick.
Real quick, yeah. Exactly, exactly.
You were active in that. When did you start performing?
Oh, gosh. Had my first professional band at 15, so we were called the Deltones.
Uh-huh.
And we were together for 10 years. I mean, we grew up to you know, we went through high school and everything and got married and
right.
a whole bit. And once that started, then we started to break apart. Everybody has their own families and such. So, it was a long time ago. It was, I think I started back in... I got involved after I watched The Beatles. I mean, that's what got me sparked.
That's such a classic story for our generation,
isn't it?
Right? Ed
yeah.
Sullivan Show.
You got it.
I want to get a Gretsch guitar like George.
There it is. That's it.
Or a Hofner Beatle
exactly,
bass like
Chris.
Paul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we should be clear that this new release is a song you recorded, what, 34 years ago?
35.
35 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a complete surprise to me that I'm even here talking to you right now. I mean, it's...
Well, how did it come about, Mike?
I got a call from a man named Roger Bong, who has his company Aloha Got Soul, that we're putting out reissues of stuff from here that wasn't the typical Hawaiian-sounding stuff. It was like R&B...
Dance music,
dance stuff, and also jazz, funk, and stuff like that,
uh-huh.
that was going on back then. And a lot of people nowadays don't even know that we had this whole realm of blues, you know, funk, jazz, dance stuff that was...
Ox, Lemuria.
Yeah, Ox, Seawind, exactly.
Seawind, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he gave me a call, and we hooked up about a year ago or so. And we started talking, and I didn't know that there was that much people that were interested in what I had done.
Uh-huh.
Because even you figure you did your first album 35 years ago.
Mike, before we run out of time, we should have you do at least one of the songs. Let's do that, have you do that B-side
okay.
song.
Was
that Tropic Lightning?
Yes, it is. I'm just going to do a few bars.
Yeah, sure.
Sensations, nice vibrations are flowing out of you. Sex and looking style, baby, when you smile, my soul cries out in me. Soul cries out in me. Tropic lightning, so exciting. You got so much electricity. Tropic lightning, so exciting. You got so much electricity. That's a little bit of it.
And that's you recorded that with a full band, so bass and drums.
Yeah, so it's a little weird for me to be just strumming it on the guitar. It's kind of like how I started to write it. You
sure.
know what I mean? Yeah.
But you know, it's always interesting to see how a song morphs into a full band
there
arrangement
you go.
From
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
from chords and,
exactly.
and melody like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, Chris. Yeah, yeah.
And yet, I don't know. There was songwriting in that era, and you can tell just from the choice of chords that you made and the rhythms that there were a lot of interesting things going on in songwriting in that, particularly late 70s, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
kind of what that sound reminds me of a little bit.
Well, you know, think back when we had all those bands like Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And, you know, I went through that whole phase, too, where we got into the horns and, you know, had to. That's where I actually learned how to transcribe.
Things
and
got
write.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you couldn't just go in and just jam. You had to have, like, sectional pieces that the horn sections had
yeah.
to play, and you had to be more. That's where you learn to be more... constructive as far as you know,
had to learn chords beyond the one, the four, or the five. Right?
Yeah, and when Blood, Sweat, and Tears came on, it was so different. You know
yeah.
what I mean? It was I mean, I really enjoyed that, the whole Chicago Blood, Sweat, and Tears time, too. Yeah.
I always felt that a lot of times the artists that we were listening to, and also Stevie Wonder, I think, would be another one, pulled us along with them as they grew, yeah?
Stevie, God, the stuff he came out
unbelievable,
with.
Unbelievable, wasn't it?
Just unbelievable. I mean.
Well, it really did pull a whole generation along in terms of the quality of everybody's music,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Mike, thanks very much for coming in, and good luck with your record release. Yeah?
Thank you so much, Chris.
Good to have you. Mike Lundy has released a vinyl 45 RPM recording of his new single, The Rhythm of Life, and it's a song originally released in 1980. The new release is on the Aloha Got Soul label. Release date is January 31st. You can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
You break it, you own it. The crime wave, that is.
The burden of proof is no longer on those who advocate broken windows. The burden of proof is on those who suggest that it doesn't have any impact on crime.
The complex legacy of a law enforcement strategy through the broken window of modern policing. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Through their generous donations, our nearly 12,000 members across the state make it possible for HPR to give voice to the many communities that make up our island home. Mahalo to Kauai residents and station members John Harder of Anahola, Barbara Esman of Kapa'a, and Robert Dolan of Kalaheo. They rely on KHPR and KIPL for their news, talk, and entertainment. If you also come to HPR for the diverse perspective shared here, show your support at hawaiipublicradio.org or call us at 808-955-8821 during business hours.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
With high housing costs, you might think Hawaii would be ripe for prefabricated homes, but you'd be wrong. Hawaii purchased only 4 of them in 2013. That's according to the latest manufactured home industry report. So why doesn't Hawaii do mobile homes? Chad Blair is back, and he's got today's reality check. Good morning. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Beth Ann. Good to be back.
Nice to have you here. Now, you know, we've heard this term, trailer trash, but there are some beautiful mobile home parks across the country, and there are even prefabricated homes that have been integrated seamlessly into regular neighborhoods. Plus, these homes are kind of cheap. Why not here?
There's a lot of reasons. And by the way, if you go on to Eric Pape's story today, that you can actually go to a slideshow showing all these beautiful mobile homes. There's some 50,000 communities across the country, and they really are quite appealing. But the reason why we don't have them here, Well, there's a lot of reasons. There's no one single big reason, but certainly the high cost of land. You know, if a developer is looking to build something, are they going to build a mobile home park or a trailer park? Or are they going to build a luxury condo? I think another thing is the permitting process. Often a complaint from businesses. There's union cost. And then you got to think about things about infrastructure and regulations for curbs and sewers and lights. So really, there's quite a lot of stuff that goes into it. And that's the reason we only bought 4 manufactured homes last year compared to 60,000 across the country.
So really, this isn't the matter of aesthetics and that they somehow are less than if you look at them in context of other homes that are built from scratch.
Right. They actually kind of blend seamlessly into, if you will, conventional homes. But, you know, it is a stereotype. You mentioned trailer trash or white trash. In the past, they've been considered to be eyesores and whatnot. But really, it's not that case at all. And cost is really the driving factor. If you can spend $64,000 on a mobile home versus $700,000 here in Honolulu, wouldn't that be an appealing factor?
But for people who perhaps, you know, inherited a piece of property and or are subdividing a piece of property to be able to put one of those homes on there, and if they look so nice, aren't there opportunities for that? I mean, it seems funny there's only 4 mobile homes that appear on this list that were sold in 2003 when everybody talks about the high cost of building a house here.
Right, and this is a topic that is part of our Living Hawaii series, which you know you and I will revisit shortly.
You bet. Thanks so much, Chad. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is back, and we'll talk to him again tomorrow morning. He is the political editor of CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak and talking about all the good that is done by vaccines. Yeah, Kathy?
Well, you can just look at Disneyland in California.
Yep.
And all the measles that have been going around. So we're going to talk today with a nationally recognized expert, Dr. Bill Atkinson. He spent 25 years at the CDC, and he's really on a mission to help educate people about what immunizations actually do, what they're for, and why they're really a safe way to avoid getting diseases that we used to think were long gone, like measles, for example.
Well, they were long gone until the anti-vaccine movement started.
Well, and a lot of that came from some information that was later debunked, published by a researcher who admitted that he falsified a lot of his data in the journals that he had published his articles in. So, you know, we saw this start of, or at least a continuation and worsening of the anti-vaccine crusaders when they would quote this information that's clearly inaccurate. So we're going to talk today, what happens when you get measles and why should we be worried? Because, you know, for those 70 or so cases that are out there, every single one of those was preventable.
And yet the ability of the internet to disseminate rumors has an awful lot to do with this. Yeah, Kathy?
Well, absolutely. I mean, people need to be careful. What sort of source are you looking at for information? You know, go to reputable websites that are sponsored by major medical centers. You know, these are the places where you're going to get the best information, and it's not going to be tainted by people trying to sell you something or by hysterical stories that aren't true. So we're going to talk today about what's the truth about vaccines and immunizations and why everybody should know their measles status right now, particularly if they're worried about traveling.
Fair enough, Kathy. It's welcome information. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Late last week, Hawaii got the news that former Governor Linda Lingle had taken a job as a senior advisor for another governor. She'll join the staff of Illinois Republican Bruce Rauner by summer. This has fueled some speculation that she might be setting up a reboot of her political career on the mainland after running up against limitations in the state she's called home for 40 years. While the move may benefit former Governor Lingle, what might it do for Hawaii's GOP. Early this morning, I talked with former Congresswoman and current chair of the Hawaiian Republican Party, Pat Saiki. There has been a lot of talk about what this move to the mainland might mean for Linda Lingle, but not so much about what the move might mean for Hawaii's GOP. Her campaigns galvanized Hawaii's Republican Party in the way yours had done it once upon a time.
Yeah.
And we really haven't seen a lot from her since she left office.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of impact do you think that her move to the mainland is going to have on Hawaii's GOP?
Well, first of all, I think it's very fortunate for Governor Rauner to have gotten Linda Lingle to assist him in getting his ship in order, because Linda is very talented, she's very skillful, and she has a lot to offer. So for her to take that job is a good fortune for Governor Rauner and a good experience for Linda. I think she's been out of the political picture since her governorship, because her lieutenant governor was a candidate for governor, and she didn't want to overshadow him. So she was kind enough to sort of sit back and let Duke carry the ball. And that's what my take was on Linda's participation. Behind the scenes, she was very helpful to the party.
What kind of behind-the-scenes work was she doing that helped to build the party?
Well, she put us in touch with some of her workers, the people that supported her. She certainly was helpful in gathering their attention, especially when it came to fundraising. And so she was behind the scenes, but very, very active.
Behind the scenes, but quiet.
Yeah, very quiet, because you know she didn't want to take the limelight away from Duke.
She very often has been in some ways accused of being the sort of the architect of the GOP, and it was for a while referred to as being the party of Linda Lingle, and whether people believe that or not, she did galvanize it in such a way that, as we said, we haven't really seen before, except for perhaps with you.
Yes, she was very helpful in building the party, and of course it was to her benefit when she decided to run for governor. So when she lost the first race, she used the base of the party to gather together those like-minded people to build the party, and I think that was very, very helpful. And a lot of those people have stayed with the party, and so whatever she did it for the purpose of building the party.
So how would you characterize her impact in going to the mainland and perhaps not going to return to Hawaii in a political way?
You don't know whether she's going to return in a political way, because you never know what's going to happen in the future. You know, like they say, never, never say never. And she is going to use this experience to broaden her base, her experience, and she's going to help Governor Rauner a lot, I think. And it's going to be for one term only, and then she intends to come back. I had a chat with her, and she said, I fully intend to come back to Hawaii.
That part hasn't really been making its way into a lot of the public discussion. So if she's making plans to come back to Hawaii, do you think her absence in the next of 4 years is going to hurt her at all?
No, I don't think so. She's gaining a lot. And the party moves on, you know. We have other races to run. The presidential race is foremost in our minds at this point. 2016 is a critical time for the nation. And certainly she's going to gain a lot of exposure and bring a lot of that back to Hawaii when she comes. When she comes back. And she assured me, she said, oh, no, she says, Hawaii is my home. I love Hawaii, and I'm going to come back.
She, like everybody else, is looking for the next move. When one job ends and you still want to be working, where that job opens up, who knows sometimes. But as you say, she's going to come back to Hawaii in this interim period when she's gone. And you mentioned that the party moves on. Do you think the party will move on in a way that will be welcoming of her when she comes back? Or will it take off in a different direction?
Of course. She was the first woman governor, and a Republican to boot, of this state. She's well known. She did a great job as governor. And certainly people here are going to welcome her back. I mean, they'd love to have her back in whatever capacity she chooses. So there's no question about that.
So you don't really buy this business that she's going to launch a political career on the mainland and with Hawaii has come to a close?
No. Oh, heavens no. There's no such thing as anything coming to a close in politics. You know that, Beth.
Well, I mean, that's some of the chatter. That's not necessarily any sort of opinion from anyone around here because we don't do that.
Chatter,
but hearing some of that chatter and wondering how that will impact the next chapter of the GOP without her in Hawaii is still a curiosity.
Oh, we will move on. Don't worry. The party moves on, and she will always be a resource that we will tap. She will always be someone that will seek for opinions because we treasure the fact that she was in such a great position when she was serving as governor. So no question, she's valuable to the party. She will always be so. And we will always look to her for advice and counsel. So, no, she's not cutting off Hawaii at all. She wants to come back. She doesn't know what the future holds for her. I had a chat with her, and we discussed this. And she said, oh, no, I'm coming back.
And Hawaii is not cutting her off either in your mind?
Heavens no. We're not going to close the door on her. She is still a very valuable source of information and experience and I mean, she's still a viable candidate. She's very much alive.
So you think she could come back here and run again?
Sure she could. Sure she could. I don't know whether she wants to, but I say anything is possible.
But that part was never discussed when you sat down to talk to her.
I got this feeling that she's going to do this work for Governor Rauner. And it's going to be a temporary thing, and she's going to help him as much as she can. And I think she'll be very valuable because of her experience here.
All right.
She expressed to me full intention of coming home. She'll be back in April, you know, before she starts her job. So you all will have a chance to question her again. We're going to honor her when she comes back.
All right. Well, thanks very much for giving us a little of your time this morning.
Sure, Beth. Really, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Even this early. Even this early. Thanks so very much. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
Pat Saiki is the chair of the Hawaii Republican Party. Her revitalization of the party propelled her to election as the first GOP representative from Hawaii after statehood. She was a member of the 100th and 101st Congresses, and we talked to her very early this morning.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about an animal that's just about everywhere in Hawaiian waters, a relative of sea anemones and jellyfish. It's more commonly thought of as a habitat for other organisms than as a living creature in its own right. Most people new to the ocean think of it as a rock or mineral, yet it spawns and reproduces, budding and growing into a network of living spaces for fish, eels, invertebrates, and other ocean life. It takes in food through a single body opening, with a mouth at the top surrounded by feeding tentacles. Stinging cells within those tentacles catch and immobilize plankton as they drift by, and when the plankton come near, a spear-like projection shoots out. So although the animal remains motionless, it has a ready supply of food. It secretes a hard exterior skeleton made of calcium carbonate that forms elaborate structures in offshore waters. And yes, those are called reefs, and the animal that creates them is, of course, coral, or kohala in Hawaiian. It's 8:45, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha. I'm Marla Momi Music, owner and designer of Pacificology. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in our island skies and the greater world of astronomy. We turn, as usual, to Christopher Phillips from the Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. First off, we have Venus setting in the west at 7:39. Following Venus will be Mars, also setting in the west at around about 8:40 p.m. If you look to the east, be sure to look out for Jupiter, which will be rising above the horizon at 7:20. We have a pass of the International Space Station on the evening of Saturday the 31st, 7:56 p.m., moving from the west-southwest to the west.
Now, Christopher, there's been some considerable snow recently here in Hawaii. You apparently have snow in our Stargazer report this week.
That's right. We visit the mountains of Venus. And, just like the mountains of the Big Island, they appear to have had some snow. The temperature on the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt a block of lead, so there is no chance of liquid water or even ice existing there. It doesn't even rain water from the clouds of Venus. Instead, it rains sulfuric acid. So this bizarre snow that has been discovered on the mountains of Venus turns out to be made of metal and crystal.
And what kind of device would be able to detect something like this?
Well, the clouds of Venus are so thick that you can't see through them in visible light. To study the surface of Venus, we use cloud-piercing radar. And for decades, NASA and the European Space Agency have been using this method to study the geology of Venus. We have discovered that practically every feature on the surface of Venus has been formed through the action of volcanism, just like here in the islands. There are channels on the surface that have been carved out by flowing lava. There are shield volcanoes, very similar to the volcanoes of Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea. And of course, there is frost and snow, made not of water ice, but of this strange metallic compound.
And then how does it actually come down? Does it come down like snow? Kind of paint a picture. If we were there, would it look like snow coming down?
Pretty much. Using data from the spacecraft, scientists do indeed think the source of this material is the clouds of Venus, although just how it forms snow and frost is still a mystery. But it's fun to think that perhaps future explorers of Venus may be able to make snowmen from metal instead of ice.
I'm thinking more about the sledding and tobogganing aspect, but I guess that's just me. Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you so much for the report.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Some performing artists fit into a long-established tradition and are easily categorized. Some create their own category. That's probably how you would describe Bo Arrow, a two-person acrobatic clown show that combines clowning, mime, acrobatics, dance, puppetry, and object theater in a wordless performance. The show's coming to the islands. Amica Hunter is half of the partnership. She's on the phone with us. Good morning.
Hi. I'm actually here with my partner and co-founder, David, so we're both on the line.
Okay. Well, let's talk to one of you to avoid confusion, all right? So
right.
What made you come up with this idea?
Well, we've been working on this show for about a year. Our previous show was pirate-themed, and so we were really enamored with the idea of pilots for our next venture, and we have sort of turn-of-the-century costumes that we just thought were automatically funny, you know, the poofy pants. Sort of went from there.
Right. And you got the aviator hats that sort of the World War One era aviator hats.
Yeah, exactly. The helmets, leather helmets, and goggles. It's a very toasty outfit to be wearing.
I bet. And was the show conceived from the beginning as a wordless show?
Yeah. So as physical theater people, we really enjoy telling stories with our bodies. We use a lot of sounds, but no words. I think there might be one or two half words in the show. But keeping it wordless allows us to play for all audiences, you know, regardless of language, regardless of age, and making sure that really comes across just in the way that we are moving.
And kind of forces you to think about what you're communicating without the benefit of language, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. It's a very relatable show. I think that we do a good job of connecting with the audience without words, and it keeps people super engaged because they really have to watch what's going on.
What's the acrobatic component?
Well, David and I both trained in acrobatics at the Circus Center in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And so we've been keeping up that practice, but we try to incorporate it in a way that's not just about showing off the skills, but actually serves to tell the story. So we have some moves thrown in here and there, sort of when you're least expecting it, you know, and they're really just sort of furthering the story of our relationship to the audience and to each other.
When you train at a place like the Circus Center, what are the things that you work on?
We both took the Clown Conservatory program. So we did a lot of studying different forms of, you know, improvisation, theater, mask work, all sorts of clown-related things. We learned some slapstick theory. Also, though, we both trained in partner acrobatics. David's done some more tumbling than I have. I used to do some flying trapeze up there. There's just pretty much every sort of circus discipline or apparatus that you could think of, there's a high-level instructor to teach you.
There was a term you just used about one of the techniques. So tell me again what those techniques were that you studied.
We studied clown and acrobatics, partner acrobatics. I did some flying trapeze, a little bit of contortion training.
Uh-huh.
We both work on our hand balancing, handstand skills.
These circus skills have really they've been broken down into some really elaborate kind of formal education in specific skills, haven't they?
Yeah, the disciplines are very distinct from one another, even though we're all sort of lumped together. And generally, people pick a focus and they go that one direction. But as clowns, we really like to be able to branch out. We have our foundation of sort of storytelling techniques and clown techniques, but then we can really incorporate whatever skills we choose to within that, which is a fun way to play around in the different categories.
When you do you have a fixed performance, or is it kind of free flowing when you get on stage?
It's always a bit of both. We generally know what's going to happen in the show, like what order things will go in, because we are telling an overarching story. But there's always room for improvisation. We played a show last night in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there was this little child that crawled onto the stage in the middle of the show, and we had a lot of fun. You know, playing with her, like I crawled towards her, and her mom pulled her back by her ankle, just as David pulled me back by my ankle, and
uh-huh.
It was a really fun moment of improvisation there.
So you have to sort of get on stage with the mindset of being ready for something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Anything can happen, and those are usually the most fun moments for us, is just playing with the surprises that always turn up in every show.
How long has Bow Arrow been in existence?
Bow and Arrow, we've been doing this show about, like, since the spring. So we toured it around this summer, doing fringe festivals in the United States. And we've been continuing to tour it until now. So it's just been a nonstop fun adventure with this show.
Continuing to evolve, I assume?
Oh, yeah. We're always tinkering with it. Every time we do a show, there's new opportunities coming our way.
You know, I know the term I was thinking of. You said there was a course in, what would you say, slapstick technique?
Yeah. We had an instructor, Joe Diefenbacher, teaching us slapstick technique. We learned, you know, it was a funny class. We learned how to run into walls, fall downstairs, trip up steps, you know, fake slapping each other, all that kind of stuff. It's really funny to see a room full of people focusing really hard on how to run into the wall again and again.
I assume there's a way to do it that's non-injurious, yeah?
Yeah. You learn how to do it right so you're not actually getting hurt, but so that it also looks convincing, you know.
So a lot of this, when you think slapstick, you think of the Keystone Comedy era, Buster Keaton and Fatty Arbuckle and people like that. Did you study old silent movies at any point?
Oh, definitely. That's a lot of our inspiration, actually, is sort of the old vaudevillian technique that morphed into the silent films that you see. And, you know, we're a big fan of Keaton. Of course, and
yeah.
I think that a lot of people sort of liken our show to that style because it's sort of, you know, silent and very physical, sort of over the top.
And, you know, Buster never telegraphed the laugh, right? He was the great stone face. And
yeah, stone face. Yeah, he had that flat expression. I think we do use a little bit more of engagement, it's just since it is a clown show, you know, we really like to look at people, and they know we're looking at them. There's no fourth wall like
yeah.
There is in theater and movies.
Well, it sounds like an awful lot of fun, Amica, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We can't wait to come out and play for you guys.
Should be fun, yeah.
Amica. Yes, we have three shows, February 12th, 13th, and 14th.
great. We'll send people your way. Amica Hunter is half of the duo Bow and Arrow, which is coming to the Oahu Fringe Festival on February 12th, 13th, and 14th. The performance is at the Aung King Arts Center in downtown Honolulu, and details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
A new administration, a new legislative session, and a new term in Hawaii. Later today, Governor David Ige gives his first State of the State address to the legislature. Join Hawaii Public Radio as the governor lays out his priorities and perspectives. Live coverage of the State of the State address starting at 10 a.m. this morning on HPR 1, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Very different political landscape in Hawaii with Linda Lingle leaving at least for a few years and a new governor giving his state of the state. The players are changing. The voices we hear are going to be different ones in the years to come.
Potentially or maybe not, as Pat Saiki was suggesting, that you never know who may boomerang and find him or herself back in a position of running for another race. But then again, we know that some of the people that we're seeing now are also people like, for example, Governor Ige spent so much time in the legislature. So not necessarily new voices, but maybe in a new position.
Well, definitely in a different context, yeah.
We'll see what happens later on today at 10 o'clock when we broadcast the State of the State. That's going to do it for us for this Monday. Coming up later in the week, some current attitudes towards science and what this means for a retooled, revivified NASA program.
And Vivo combines vocals, clarinet, and violin live in our studio.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm at BKOZHPR.
Our past shows are on the HPR2 archive, as are links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.